I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is February 18th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen, present. Wasilewick, Amy.
Wasilewick, present.
Heintzman, Josh. Heintzman, Josh. Acomb, Patty. Acomb, Patty. Ackland, Susan. Ackland, Susan. Becker, Jeff.
Becker, present.
Becker, Finn, Jamie.
Present.
Eklund, Rob.
Present.
Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, present.
Green, Steve.
Present.
Igo, Spencer.
Present.
Jordan, Sydney.
Here.
Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, present.
Lee, Fu.
Lee, present.
Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, present.
Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, present.
Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, present.
Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, present.
Tice, Tama.
Tice, present.
And then Heintzman, Josh.
All right, let's try again. Is that working? Heintzman, present.
Okay, hear you. Sorry about that. Acomb, Patty.
Acomb, present.
Ackland, Susan. Ackland, Susan. McCorin, quorum is present.
Quorum is present. The next item on the agenda are the minutes for Tuesday, February 16th. Representative Heintzman, do you want to move the minutes?
Matter of fact, Mr. Chair, I did look at the minutes, and I would move them.
Representative Heintzman moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Before we start, I do want to acknowledge Molly Peterson is back, and on behalf of the committee, I want to express our condolences for the loss of your father.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I appreciate everyone's support.
Thinking about you. First up, we have four bills today, members, and the first one is House File 634, the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And our target time on this is to go to about 1:40. So, Representative Becker Finn, will you move the House File 634 be recommended to be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker Finn moved. I believe you have an author's amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment. There was a little bit of confusion about some language regarding easements. This language has been vetted by the Outdoor Heritage Council leadership and just clears up some things moving forward.
Representative Becker Finn moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Representative Becker Finn, to your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is the annual Outdoor Heritage Fund allocation. For folks who are unfamiliar, the Outdoor Heritage Fund is one of our legacy funds, and expressly the funds need to be used to restore, protect, and enhance Minnesota's wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So the restore, protect, enhance is the key words as we move this bill forward. This is now the 13th year of these constitutionally dedicated funds, and at this point, $1.2 billion have been allocated from the Outdoor Heritage Fund in those first 12 years. This bill this year is about $127,000 or $127 million that will be allocated hopefully this year These are the recommendations of the council. It did pass the council with little to no controversy. And with that, I will hand it off to Mark Johnson, the executive director, or Joe, one of our staffers, can walk through to give a short summary.
Mr. Johnson or Mr. Pavelko?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mark Johnson, executive director for the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Becker Finn. Members, there are a couple of handouts for you for the bill, that you can take a look at. There first is a bill summary, which looks like this, and it's a has some wonderful charts inside you can take a look at, and then on the back it also has the appropriations listed out that are in the bill. Quickly, I'll give you an overview of the bill. There are 10 subdivisions within the bill. There are about five of those that deal with funding, and those are subdivision two is the prairies section. There's about $42 million proposed for funding to the prairies section across the state, or prairies work. Subdivision three goes into the forests, and there are another $12 million of appropriations to the forests. Or to projects within the forest. Wetlands is another big portion, although there's only seven appropriations in it. It's subdivision four. It's $22 million worth of appropriations. Subdivision five gets into the habitats portion, which is the largest of the bill, where there is 18 appropriations, actually, for $48.6 million of the funding, so the lion's share of the funding in the habitats portion. And then subdivision six is an administrative portion that has the budget. It has some monies to the legacy website and things like that, and it comes to $934,000 in the first year, and then the second year, $557,000. The council puts forth annual recommendations to the legislature, but the budgets are done in the first year of the biennium. And that's why you see the first and the second year here within subdivision six. The next thing I should call your attention to is at the end, it'd be subdivision 10. And there are some carry forwards there. There are actually eight extensions of previous appropriations that are being recommended by the council. And those extensions are all for projects that have definitely noticed COVID-related delays. These extensions will allow those carry forwards or those projects to continue their work and to spend the money as they should and to finish up their programs. Most of them are really toward the end of their work, and this just gets them a chance to finish it up with good colors and not stop halfway. That's a nice thing. Actual appropriations themselves, as I mentioned, this brochure that we pointed out, if you look at the front of the brochure, gives you a really good overview of the different breakdowns with regards to the number of acres. There's about 97,000 acres that are going to be impacted by this bill, if it's passed as is, 81 miles of shoreline and so on. I'll call your attention next to the middle section so I can quickly go through that with you, and then we can take questions if you have those on there. But in the top left portion, it says output by acres, and then over in the top right is outputs by funding. So really this whole, your whole left side of the page deals with how the acres break out across the state, whereas the whole right side of your page deals with how the funding breaks out in the same way as the acres. It just puts it into dollar figures. So the two pie charts on the top, the one on the left is you can see how it breaks down across the acres breakdown by activity. And with the majority of the acres being 74% for enhancement across these projects that are proposed. Over on the right side, you can conversely, you can contrast that from the dollar standpoint. The same colors apply on both sides. So the light blue is enhancement and light blue is enhancement over here. But you can see that the amount of money for that 71% of the acreage work is really only 25% of the dollars, which just underscores that different activities cost different or have different costs to them. And that's really one thing for you to be able to realize out of this. The bar charts in the middle of the page, you'll see as you look at those, have the breakdown of the distribution of acres by ecological section. And that's across the state. And in the very top middle, there's this picture of the state of Minnesota, which has the ecological sections that the council recognizes and how these projects are broken down. And again, as we've seen for most years, the bulk of work will take place in the prairie section. The bulk of the acres is there with almost 43 million acres worth of activity. And if you slide over again to the right, to the funding side, you can see that the bulk of the dollars is also there with $51 million worth of the appropriations going into those prairie ecosections for the work that will happen there. And then it does break out the metro urban area, the forest prairie transition zone, southeast, and so on for all of these different, these five different ecosections or ecological sections as they're recognized. The very bottom are some bar charts that are a little different, and they look at more from a budgetary standpoint within the proposals. So there are resource types that the budgets break down in each of the projects as they come forward. And those resource types are wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitats. So this gives you just gives us a little different view of how it breaks down from those resource types for dollars and for acres. Mr. Chair and members on the back, of course, as I mentioned, are the appropriations as they're listed in the bill. So this just gives you a thumbnail view or one page view of how they all break out within those individual subdivisions of the bill. Mr. Chair, I can go into things individually or more deeply if you wish, or if Representative Becker Finn wishes, but that's a pretty higher level view of the bill at this point.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to clarify for members, just so they're aware, when we talk about the metropolitan urbanizing area, we're using the larger definition of the 11 county metro. So it's, you know, Wright County, Isani County, Chisago, just to be clear about what that definition is, because I know that that definition shifts depending upon what you're talking about. So just want to make that clear.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for the delay. I wasn't expecting to be called on quite so soon. I would normally have a bunch of questions, but I know that the committees get cut short. I'd like to point out a few things and then ask Mr. Johnson a couple questions and then inform him that I'll probably be, if I don't get the answers today, I'll be asking them again in the legacy committee. But just to point out a few things, if you look through the bill, and I won't go through it page by page, but there's a lot of acres that are in this bill to be purchased that the money's there, but there really is no description of the acres. It's just, here's some money, go find some acres. That's always been a problem for me, and it really has been a problem for me. But there's other things in the bill, and maybe this would be a question for Mr. Johnson. There's money in here that's going to be going to the Nature Conservancy. And it's, I believe, almost $3 million, and it's to purchase some land. And in the description in the big book that breaks down everything, the Nature Conservancy admits that they're not going to have the money to manage this land the way it needs to be managed, and that they will be coming back for more funding to manage the land. And I'm just wondering, is that for the sake of the committee, is that pretty standard that when non-government entities or organizations come in, that they don't expect to have the money for the management of the property, so they just keep coming back to the state for more. And if that's the case, why hand it out to these agencies that aren't going to have the money to do it?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, I'm not sure which one you're referring to from the appropriations. Nature Conservancy has at least two direct appropriations to them in this bill, and they're involved in a few of others. But in general, for your question, normally when property is acquired in fee, at least with Outdoor Heritage Funds, it's presumed by the council, and it's general practice that those properties are also enhanced or restored up to a certain level so that they can then be maintained from there on. In almost all cases, that's the way it happens. I'm not sure there are some instances such as with like the Northern Tallgrass Prairie, which is a direct appropriation to TNC, and that's a little over $3 million. So that might be the one you're talking about. In that, if there's land that's acquired in fee, it will be turned over to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they actually will do the restorations and enhancements on those properties. They will also manage them going forward, and then they'll be open to public hunting as well within that National Wildlife Refuge system during open seasons. The easements that are also acquired in that will be held also by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so they'll be doing also the work on those. There might be some funds out of that $3 million. They're also used for enhancement and restoration of those properties, those native prairies. But generally, for any ongoing maintenance, especially in this case, the federal government will be responsible for that, and they have agreed to that.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you'll find this, Mr. Johnson, you'll find this on page 3 of the bill. It's the Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project. It's $2.794 million. And in the larger description, it does explain, and I won't give you the page because nobody has this, that you'll be placed in a dedicated account for further property tax payments, which is great. But then it says, our past efforts show that the revenue generation is insufficient to pay all the associated expenses. Therefore, we plan to seek future funding from Outdoor Heritage Fund with private contributions and long-term stewardship. So they don't have the money to maintain this. And I could go on and on. I'm going to ask one more question, and then because I see you got more, and I know you want to get done. And it falls in the same groove here. There's also money in here that goes to Pheasants Forever, and the Pheasants Forever is getting money from Lassard Sams to acquire land, and it states in the book that their intention, along with Nature Conservancy, does the same thing. You just said that. To turn the land back over to the state after they acquire it. So if we're going to give money to NGOs to purchase property and with the intent that the property is going to be turned back over to the state, what is the point of even doing that? Do they get to pay more for the acres? What's the average price per acre? Why go through that rigmarole when it's all gonna come back in a circle?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, that's a really good question. And sometimes it's just economy of scale. Other times it's because of the preference of the landowner. There are some landowners who do want their properties to go into wildlife management area, but they don't want to sell it to the state. They'd rather that it goes to Pheasants Forever or to another NGO so that property then can is brought up to standards that they trust that NGO to do the work. At other times also, there are simply instances where it's less expensive for those that appropriation to happen through the hands of an NGO. And for whatever reason that might be. There's a unique niche for the NGOs in those acquisitions, and that's why the council has seen fit to to fund those efforts over the years. You're correct. Also, Ducks Unlimited and other NGOs have done acquisitions as well. I think there are 20 different NGOs that are recipients this year within these proposals that are in the bill.
Representative Green, more questions
later? Just a comment, and I'll save the questions for later if there's time. But the comment is, you know, we see this all the time every year. And it's, you know, I hear the stories of that only 10% over the assessed cost can be paid for this property. But I can take you to instances where much more has been paid. The NGOs are being used as a tool, I believe, a willful tool. And it doesn't really make a lot of sense. I'd like to see the breakdown of how much this land gets turned back. The other issue is that when we're given money to the Nature Conservancy, for instance, and then this land is turned over to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, so we're using Minnesota dollars to acquire federal land. And so there's a lot of problems with this bill. Every year we go through this bill, and this is the book, if you can see it, of what's in this huge bill. And there's 127.8 million dollars that we're discussing here, and we're going to get it rammed through in 40 minutes, and it's not even remotely possible to go through the things in this bill. And I believe that the legislature just fails greatly in trying to in just pushing this through with recommendations when a lot of the times nobody even knows what we're passing here. So I'll say whatever, if there's any time left, otherwise I'll catch it in legacy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Beckerfin, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's pretty important. One thing I am really struggling to see, though, is an equity lens for this bill. Maybe, Mr. Johnson, can you talk a little bit more about what you're doing to increase outdoor recreation opportunities for individuals of color, people living in, like, my city, which is Minneapolis, for example?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan, thanks for that question. The primary thing that's happening with respect to access for all peoples is, of course, comes through the acquisition of these properties. The conservation easements are not open to public. Generally, it's private lands that stay on the tax rolls, and the private landowner still has control of them, but they're protected in perpetuity. And then, of course, there's a management plan that goes with those. So they enhance the area, but they don't necessarily allow for you or I or anybody else to walk on those private lands. So public land acquisition is one way that the Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars provide that access. In the council always looks at projects within the metro area especially. It's a very challenging area for projects from a habitat standpoint to happen. Metro Big Rivers is one wonderful one within the project that is a kind of a perpetual funding program each year, and it's they work, but it's, as I mentioned, it's a very challenging area because land costs are really high, and a lot of times the land just isn't there to buy. So they're always looking very closely for those opportunities. From a standpoint of overall across the state, one thing that I severely flubbed the question the other day with the Legacy Committee about equity and how we reach out. But I did send an email later to members. So I thank you for the question. I get a chance to reiterate so the right side of the question. We do reach out especially to the tribal communities, and I've done that personally. We have had appropriations that have gone to the White Earth Nation as well as the Fond du Lac tribe in the past. Those have been multi-million dollar appropriations. There are also in the small grants program, the CPL programs, we have some tribes that have, some bands, I should say, that have benefited from those. We also have in the larger grants and the small grants, bands that, as well as the 1854 Treaty Authority, who are involved as partners and collaborators within those projects and those programs. So we'd love to see more projects coming from them and from other communities of color. The probably the biggest challenge that they have at this point is having a nonprofit that will be their recipient and kind of their fiscal agent moving forward. The DNR also has a very concerted effort to try to engage those people with us.
Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Johnson, for answering that. I'm glad to see we're working on this since our legacy committee meeting a few weeks ago. I would really like to see a lot more being done to make sure our public lands can really be used and beneficial to everyone in the public. That's a huge passion of mine. I think it's a big passion for a lot of people on this committee as well. So I'm hoping we can see more to make sure that it's that we have a lot of people of color who do hunt and fish in my community. I know that there are a lot of fishing opportunities even in my own district, even though we don't have a lake, but we do have the Mississippi River. And so I think it's important that we're making sure that we're emphasizing these opportunities for everyone and making sure that we are including all people in this bill. So thank you again for your answer, and I look forward to hearing more about the bill.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Johnson. Continuing on with what Representative Jordan has said, and to Representative Becker Finn's point around the definition that's used on the map for the metro area, where it's the larger 11 county metro area. Mr. Johnson, knowing that this is, you know, a statewide sales tax that's going into this, can you, from the package that we have available, can you give us a breakdown of how much of that is coming from the 7 county metro area, and how many projects are located, in the 7 county metro area, and specifically, do you know of any project right now that may be in Minneapolis?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, I can't tell you offhand how many of these projects, because I just don't have it on my fingertips, actually have projects. How many of these projects are actually in the metro area? I can find that out and get that information back to you. I do know that there's about 2,500 acres, just about 2,600 acres, that are going to be impacted, you know, worked on or acquired or whatever in the metropolitan area. And about $9 million is currently identified as going into projects within the area. There could be more of that, but that's what we have identified at this point. Now, one more thing is this does not include the CPL grants in the charts. And CPL are the small grants. It's going to be about, $9 million roughly of the appropriation. And of that, at least $2.5 million is earmarked for the 7 county metro. So there could be more. There definitely will be more work than that happening. As far as projects, the one that just pops to the top of my head right now is Pig's Eye Lake, which is about, 3 miles as the crow flies from the Capitol here, maybe less. There's a actually construction of new islands within that lake to help settle the winds and the turbulence of that Pig's Eye Lake to a greater degree, so that we actually have a lake where there's, you don't have the turbidity, there's much more natural growth of the aquatic life. And of course, from that, we'll end up with better fish and bird, fish and wildlife habitat, and also a great opportunity for more wildlife viewing for the public.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last follow-up to Mr. Johnson. Can you provide this breakdown to the committee on where these projects are located throughout the state? And I want to know, what is the council doing to ensure, you know, geographic balance and equity with regards to the funding? And also, you identified in your remarks to Representative Jordan's question that one challenge is with some of the issue that's going on in the metro area is that there's no issue finding nonprofits to be fiscal sponsors for some of these projects. Can you tell me what your office is doing to address this challenge of, you know, ensuring that there are nonprofits that's able to take on these projects for the local communities here in the areas that we represent down here? Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The last question you had, especially at first, if any time that we become aware of anyone who has a project that needs a fiscal agent, we try to yoke them with one of the nonprofits. And it might be Great River Greening, it could be Pheasants Forever, it could be Deer Hunters Association or Nature Conservancy, whoever it might be, that Minnesota Land Trust, et cetera. whoever has potential to help them with that situation. I'd say that really more so it's those NGOs reaching out into the communities that are able to find those projects and bring in those communities and bring them forward. At least I think that's probably where more of that communication happens. I also try to reach out. We try to reach out every year to each of the legislative members to ask that, you know, if you have any, and it's an open invitation always, if you have anybody in your area who's interested in how Outdoor Heritage Funds might apply to them or how they might fit for projects they have in mind, we'd love to talk to them. And our staff is readily available for that. And if for some reason it's not the right fit for Outdoor Heritage Funds because of an allowable use of the funds, then we try to help them to get to the proper funding authority, whether that's Parks and Trails or somebody else. The idea of for a map expressing exactly where these projects are across the state, looking at the bill as it is right now, I could put together a map for you, but it wouldn't mean anything because that map would be simply a wish list of where the projects are anticipated as being. Each one of the projects, unless it's a very finite footprint, Klondike Creek, which is way up north in Roseau County or Kitson County, unless it's a very finite deal, they actually provide a parcel list that shows where they are planning areas that they are planning to do their work. And then it's really, if it's an acquisition project where they're going to be acquiring a piece of land by fee or an easement, what we end up with is the willingness of the landowner and whether those properties are actually going to be available. From a conservation easement standpoint, easements are done, they know the areas they're going to work in, but they still have to, they put out an RFP for easements or with the locals. And a lot of times those easements are acquired based on how much the landowner wants. Are they willing to discount the easement? Is the land actually, or the area of the easement actually sensitive and in need of protection and so on? In other cases, such as the RIM program, about $13 million or so of these dollars are going to be going into RIM projects where Bowser is working on easements, conservation easements. They know where they want to work, but they still have to, they only know the basic geographic area, and they still have to fine-tune that by talking to the landowners and finding out which lands are actually available. So I hope you'll excuse that definition, but a kind of a map of where all these projects are going to be isn't very helpful at this point. It's kind of a shot in the sky because the details are in, you know, that's where what we need to find out, especially as things move along. There is a map that was provided to you in the project that shows all of the projects currently completed across the state. So you can look at that. I don't have it printed in front of me, but every county of the state has projects across them. But I would be happy to provide more information if there's something you would like. Please feel free to email it to me or Representative Becker Finn, and we'll definitely get you that.
Get to a couple other questions here. So Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. This question is for Mr. Johnson. First question I have is kind of I know you won't have the information, but I would like to see it. As we've been talking about dollars in the metropolitan area, it would be good to know what dollars are for acres for purchase and restoration in Hennepin County and in St. Paul, the number of acres and what the dollars are. I would like to know that. And I hear allowable uses. Would that be fishing or hunting? How is that being determined there?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher. Thank you for that question. Allowable uses, as I used it in that term, I think what I was referring to was outdoor heritage funds must be used to protect, restore, and enhance habitat for fish, game, and wildlife, or preventing forest consolidation or forest fragmentation and encouraging forest consolidation. The uses of the property, there is in statute as well as in the Constitution, any acquired parcels, acquired in fee, that is, must be open to hunting and fishing, or hunting, fishing, gathering is allowed by law in open season. So there, unless, of course, there's a special case, in which case the commissioner provides that that determination. So if it's within a city limit where you really shouldn't have firearms, so we only have archery availability or something. So those are those allowable uses that I was referring to, sir.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Representative Chair Hansen. So based on that definition, then I know that firearms, I know for sure, is not allowed in Ramsey County. So that would mean none of these, but would that be accurate then? If you have to have all of those, that means Ramsey County would not be eligible for any funds for acre acquisition?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, very good question. Thank you for that, for allowing me to clarify on that. No, it does not mean that they're not eligible by any means. So in law, it must be open hunting and fishing, approximately, that's the words, unless otherwise allowed by law. So there are opportunities. It could be that that hunting just doesn't make sense, but if it's the land has to be allowable for use by the public. So if fishing is only the right thing for the area, great. If it's only for hiking and for viewing animals, great. But it has to be allowed, it has to be open to the public. And of course, there's the allowance for hunting and fishing is whenever it makes sense, really. And that's that's left up to the Department of Natural Resources and the commissioner to make those determinations, and they're quite willing to work with the local units of government to review all of those cases. So I hope that answers your question, sir.
Representative Fisher, I got to move to get Representative Heinzman and then Representative Becker Finn, and I had a question too. So Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm very familiar with the LCCMR, as you know, and the projects that are there, but I'm pretty new to the intricate details of the project's functions in this subject area. And one of the things I see throughout the bill is shallow lake wetland protection and restoration. And I'm wondering if you might help me. I've known a number of projects at the LCCMR that actually did a restoration where sediment had been an issue, and for lack of a better word, they were dredging, and they brought back recreational value that had been lost. Do you ever see projects like that come through, and is there any project like that in this bill?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, thank you for that question. By the way, congratulations and welcome to the council. You've been appointed to the council, and we look forward to having you with us. There may be a project like that in this bill with some, but I don't, none of them come to mind that have dredging. There are some projects where they're actually putting back the re-meandering streams and rivers and things of that nature. There are projects though that are doing for shallow lake restoration or wetland restorations where they're going into areas where those shallow lake or wetlands had been filled in, and then they're taking that sediment back out to allow down to the correct levels and the correct strata of sediment, so that they can set correct strata of soils, I should say, so that they can repair that wetland or restore that wetland. And I forgot if you had another question, another section of your question there, sir.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that was it. Thank you for your answer.
Before we move to Representative Becker Finn, unless you had a comment on, want to hold till the close? Okay. So, Mr. Johnson, we're at the middle point. We're at year 13 of 25 years, and we've spent $1.2 billion. And, you know, throughout the presentation and throughout previous presentation, it always seems like acres acquired is the outcome. And so my concern is, you know, Representative Becker Finn read the
the actual constitutional language to protect, restore, and enhance prairies, wetlands, forests, and fish, game, and wildlife habitat. So are there instances where we have protected, let's say, an endangered species in a forest? Have we have we protected a tract of land that has a unique wetland or a fen on it that would have been lost to development or to agriculture or to a cabin? Can we point out some outcomes where there's a prairie that was a natural prairie that had never gone under the plow that we have saved and it's restored? And I also want to kind of look at the question through the lens of climate change, because as our temperate zones change and the unique bands of microclimates are there throughout the state, does the habitat change? You know, are we protecting habitat that is for unique species that might change but for this money? What is the outcome but for this money that we are doing after this massive investment? Because if we're not doing that, if we're just acquiring acres that we can't point to an outcome, then we need a mid-course correction to actually follow the Constitution and protect unique areas of prairies, wetlands, or forest or habitat that would otherwise be lost, either through climate development, recreational cabins, agriculture, whatever the threat is, or contamination. If we protect an area, if we acquire an area, but it still is being affected with contaminants. So that's my question. I think that's the question of what are we accomplishing here for the purpose of the Constitution.
Mr. Chair, thank you. There are thousands or hundreds and not thousands of stories already that we need a catalog about the great work that's already happened. In this project alone, you mentioned about fens. There is an incredible fen, and I think it's the largest and one of the most sensitive in the state. It's up in that. It's under the Klondike Clean Water Retention Program where it'll be impacted. Actually, that project, it's allowing some transfers of lands to further protect the fen and allow DNR to do some greater work on that as they work with the watershed district up there in doing some other water control and remeandering and so on in streams. There, as far as endangered species, in every application, every call for funding requests, we ask that all of the applicants put in there exactly what species, especially endangered or species that are sensitive or greatest need, are being affected by this. If you talk to Neil Feakin and the Nature Conservancy or Greg Hoke with DNR, you can find out some of the incredible stuff with native prairie orchids that are endangered that have now been tracts of land that have been protected in perpetuity, or the regal fritillary area, or some of these other butterflies that, you know, I never even knew what they, well, I guess I knew what they were before, but I never knew about the sensitivity. And the incredible number of acres of their habitat that has been impacted and saved or restored and protected that now is producing those butterflies and allowing that continued resource. Our job is going to be is one of the biggest jobs that we have is cataloging all these wonderful stories as we go forward, and we're trying, and we're going to succeed. There from a climate change standpoint, there are some really interesting questions that we need to keep asking. One of them, of course, is, you know, reforestation is wonderful for carbon sequestration because those trees hold that carbon in their bodies. And there's some in the Moose Habitat Restoration Project that's in here. There's some beautiful forest restoration up in Moose Country that's happening, adding in those longer lived species. And this is, I think, phase three or four. I think it's phase four of that. So there's some wonderful work happening. But also in the prairies, all of that prairie restoration that happens is of huge carbon sequestration consequence and huge climate change confidence. The remember that once a prairie grows, it puts that, it doesn't have the big body above the ground. It puts the carbon in the soil and it stays there forever unless that soil is turned. And of course, if we're protecting those prairies, there it is. You've got it. You're locking it in. There are some other questions, though, that I was talking with Neil Feakin and Greg Hoke the other day. We were chatting just about this basic thing, this climate change and the projects and the resilience of the projects as we move forward. And there are some small things, such as, you know, they've been using local ecotype native grasses and native forbs and everything in prairie restorations and everything else, trying to get the seed within a 50-mile range and so on. But if we're actually looking at, you know, having a climate from further south move north, so in other words, things are going to get hotter, should we really be looking at having a wider range for those local ecotype or local genotypes of seed? Should they really be coming from, you know, up to 100 miles south or a little further? We don't know the answer for that, and there's not the science to back that up yet, but it's questions that the scientific community is asking and our project managers are asking within their own communities. So it's definitely on the minds of people. Thank you for this. Your question stimulates so many wonderful things when I think of the stories. And that's what we have to bring to the public next, is all these stories of how this is impacting from an outcomes standpoint. How many more butterflies, how many more birds are they going to survive, and so on.
Representative Becker-Finn to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to correct the record on a few things. First, we may be spending 50 minutes on this bill in committee, but these recommendations don't just come out of nowhere. They come out of a full year of work by the council, which is primarily made up of members of the public. There's equal bipartisan representation from the legislature on the council. Senator Lang is carrying this in the Senate. And we meet nearly every month and sometimes several times a month to go through. We literally read that big binder that Representative Green held up. We read through that whole thing and we get presentations from every single project. And thanks to a law we passed 2 years ago, those meetings are all video recorded and streamed and available to the public so that people can follow along with exactly what those discussions are and what we're doing with that work. So I want to make sure that people realize that. The second thing is regarding the questions about the allowable uses. And so, you know, if you look at the actual Constitution, it's restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat. And that habitat is for fish, game, and wildlife. So wildlife would be the animals that aren't game. So it's meant to include all of those things. And further, you know, in the first 12 years, I think that the word protect has been interpreted by a lot of folks to only mean acquire. And the reality is that if we had meant for it to say acquire, the legislature would have used the word acquire. And so there have been more discussions in the last year or so about expanding, you know, sticking to restore, enhance, protect. But, you know, how can we have to be open to more options, even staying within that language. There are other ways to protect things other than just buying the land. And so it's not to say that we shouldn't be purchasing land, but keeping our mind open to different ways that we can protect, restore, and enhance that habitat. And further, to the question about whether the land has to be open to public hunting and fishing, first, the provision in the Constitution is only about land acquired by fee. So all those dollars spent on things other than acquiring land, there is nothing about hunting or fishing in the Constitution that is linked to those other projects. They don't necessarily have to be open to hunting and fishing if it's land that you're restoring and not purchasing, for example. Folks know I'm a lifelong hunter and angler and support all of those things, but I do think it's important because there has been the misperception within the public that we can't do projects inside the city limits of different places because you can't, you know, fire a rifle within the city of Roseville. And that's just completely false. These dollars are paid for by every single Minnesotan who pays sales tax, and we should be spending them in a way that benefits every Minnesotan. And so we're on the right track, and I really appreciate the discussion today, and would ask for your support for House File 634 as amended.
Representative Beckerfin renews her motion that House File 634 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Anson Rick.
Aye.
Anson, aye. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heintzeman, Josh.
Aye.
Heintzeman, aye. Akram, Patty.
Aye.
Akram, aye. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Backer, Jeff.
No.
Backer, no. Beckerfin, Jamie.
Aye.
Beckerfin, aye. Ackland, Rob.
Aye.
Ackland, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve.
No.
Green, no. I go, Spencer.
I go, aye.
I go, aye. Jordan, Cindy.
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Foo.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Tice, Tama.
Aye.
Sorry, can you repeat that, Representative Tice?
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye. Thank you. 17 ayes and 2 noes.
The motion prevails. Next up, House File 76, Beckerfin, outdoor recreation account established. And I had till 2 o'clock here. Hopefully we can get that done by 2:05 because this bill is going to be laid over, not voted out. Representative Beckerfin, will you move House File 76 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair, and I would also move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment updates the bill in 2 ways. We are changing the word recreation to engagement to better reflect the goals of this bill, and then seeding the account with $2 million. And that is the A1 amendment. I would also move that amendment.
Representative Beckerfin moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author likes. Is there any discussion that would like? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Beckerfin, to your bill as amended. And I see we have a lot of testifiers. Again, we want to get this done by 2:05.
We shall do our best, Mr. Chair. This is essentially the No Child Left Inside grant program version 2.0. We started this program last biennium, and it exceeded even my own high expectations for what could be possible when we break down barriers and just focus on getting kids outdoors. The original language is now in statute in section 84.976. Our focus is on maximizing participation, using already existing public parks and resources, and serving kids who otherwise would not be participating in these outdoor activities. So this program is not for kids like mine, but for kids who otherwise would not have access to fishing on a frozen lake or learning more about trees. With this 2.0 amendment, the A1 amendment, last year, 2 years ago, we had this account at $1.2 million and easily exceeded demand with that. The other idea with setting up this account is that private organizations or citizens have the ability to contribute to more extend the goal of this bill even further. Finally, this connects well with my first bill today. If we're going to invest billions of tax dollar money into protecting, restoring, and enhancing habitat, we need to make sure we're providing access to those spaces and promoting education of our young people so they know that it's worth protecting. With that, I will turn it over to Jeff Lederman with the DNR to share a little bit about the numbers with the program in its first year.
Mr. Lederman, if you could introduce yourself and who you're with for the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Beckerfin and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jeff Lederman. I work for the Department of Natural Resources, and I coordinate our outreach grant programs within the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Representative Beckerfin gave you quite some of the background, but I'll just highlight for those of you that are new to the committee a couple of components of that. When we were given the program to develop, we consulted with multiple stakeholders, and out of that discussions and some of our previous experience with our angler and hunter recruitment and retention grants, that led us to quickly decide to offer an initial phase of mini grants to test the interest in the program. And we were blown away by the response. The phase one mini grants opened for applications on October 23rd, 2019 at 9 o'clock a.m. with about 6 weeks notice. It was a first come, first served process. We had about $200,000 designated for that and a $5,000 maximum. We had 200 applications by 9.06 a.m., and by the end of the day, we had over 400 applications requesting over $1.2 million. As Representative Beckerfin said, it exceeded my expectations also, but it was wonderful to see. We ended up funding 59 projects out of that, which were distributed by capita to six regions in the state. And was discussed, we have made it a priority to try and reach underserved audiences. And out of those applicants in that first mini grant round, the average rate of free and reduced lunch of participants was 39.7%. So we were pretty happy to see quite a bit of underserved representation in those applications. We did a second phase of the larger grants up to $50,000 in early January, during January of 2020 with, again, 6 weeks notice. This was a competitive round. We had about $1 million left for that round. And we received 220 applications requesting over $5 million, And the average request was about $23,000. We were only able to fund about 34 projects out of that, and again, distributed across the state. The applications we've received have been a really good mix of nonprofit organizations and then more formal public schools and other public entities. Couple of other notes. It's taken us about one full-time equivalent to manage this program to date so far. We've had a really good response from tribal organizations in particular and many projects working with diverse communities. Many of the projects are still in process. Many of them were delayed because of the pandemic and will be wrapping up this summer and then a few next year. But I'm estimating that we've had about at least half of the participants are working with underserved audiences. I'll have more details on that later this year. The program has generated significant amount of
wrap up.
Okay, so several news stories and interest from across the country that are in other states are looking to do similar programs, and we're getting requests almost daily to for people who would like to get in the program and let us know. We'll be letting them know. We've been taking a list of folks that might want to apply in the future. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
If you could get a summary, if it's not posted already, we could get that out so the public can see it. I'm going to go with Hannah Garasu, and then Anna Sherritt, and then Vince Patton.
Hello, committee. Hello, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible for me to share my screen? I've prepared just three or four slides to show some data about what I have to say about the program.
You could introduce yourself and who you're with for the record and maybe one slide. I'm sorry, but we've got to get through.
Sure. Okay. My name is Hannah Garasu. I am a Master of Public Health student at the University of Minnesota, and I came to learn of this program through a research project that I conducted in late 2020 for a health policy course. So I'll share my screen now if I can. All right, are you able to see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So my main point I'd like to make here is to hopefully increase tribal participation in the No Child Left Inside program. As I'm sure the committee is aware, tribes are eligible to apply for grants. In my research, I noticed that in the first phase of the mini grants where 59 were given, no grants were awarded to a Native American tribe. And then in the phase two information, I noticed that one grant was awarded to a Native American tribe, which was the Lower Sioux Indian community. And so my suggestion is that perhaps we could set aside some grants that are exclusively given to Native American tribes so that some get them. An alternative approach would be to perhaps improve communication between the DNR and Native American tribes to increase awareness of the availability of these grants for Native American tribes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anna Sherritt.
Mr. Chair, I believe the testifier is muted.
Mr. Strohmeyer?
Mr. Chair, the testifier is not muted. So it must be an audio problem.
Okay, we're going to go to Mr. Patton. We're not able to hear Ms. Sherritt.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Vincent Patton. I am a teacher at South High School in the All Nations program. I was a recipient of both the mini grant and the larger grant of the No Child Left Inside. Quick background, I teach in a Native American program that is located within South High in Minneapolis, which is the public school, so we're a school within the school. We have implemented multiple experiences that allow children to get outside. And with that, for the last 4 years, we have seen a graduation increase from 24% when I started to now projected 76% graduation rate within our school. Last year, before the pandemic, the graduation rate was at 47%. So we basically doubled the graduation rate with the implementation of these mini grants and other grants that get kids outside. An example would be going hunting. We always take a buffalo from my reservation in South Dakota. We take our students up to Mille Lacs Lake to go fishing and camping over the week and learn about fishery programs and the jobs. And finally, we bring kids fishing in the spring, ice fishing and in the and then in the spring, we do the same thing, open water fishing. So I can see the impact that has within my students every single day. So I'm happy to say that I really hope that this program does have that increased funding. Also, the aspect of increased tribal participation would be high on my list. And another recommendation I have is outside spending. I am not from a tribal group from here in Minnesota. I am from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation out in South Dakota, which where we harvest our buffalo. But because of the language of the grant, it kept us within only the state of Minnesota, which then kind of limited the idea of spending any money outside the state. So those are my recommendations, but I thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. Rich Cordemanch, Land Commissioner, Aiken County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here in support of 76. Representative Becker Finn said, they was highly sought after and they was very competitive. There's so much pent up demand for this. I'm here representing three different groups. I'm the chair of the North Central Landscape Committee, and our recent landscape level plan calls out environmental education as one of the number one. It is the number one priority for our social needs, because getting kids out and developing as environmental literacy is imperative because for our region. I'm also here in support from as an Aiken County rural county representative. Our goals mimic those of the North Central Landscape Plan, and it recognizes many of our constituents and stakeholders are coming from outside our community. We depend heavily on tourism, lake homes, hunting, and educating our citizenry on the value of working forest, timber, wildlife, clean water. It's vital. Half of our county's land base, 600,000 acres of the 1.2 million acres in Aiken County, are public. And this bill would help educate and develop an appreciation for public land management and the recreation possibilities vital to our community. I'm also the administrator of an environmental learning center. School districts who come to Long Lake or Environmental Learning Center in Palisade are finding hard to find funding for the shrinking budgets. and the not to mention COVID, as well as the economic disparity that's occurring. And so having funds like this would really help bring students out into the environment to appreciate the outdoor recreation and to support our way of life in northern Minnesota. So from these three perspectives, I'd like to add my support for House File 76.
Thank you, Mr. Gordomach. We're going to go back to Anna Charrett. Ms. Sherritt? Oh, I guess we still have some trouble. We're going to go to Matthew Young, Minnesota Association of Environmental Education. Mr. Young.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Hansen, Representative Becker-Finn, and committee for listening to my testimony today. Again, my name is Matthew Young, and I was privileged to serve from January 2019 through December 2020 as the Advocacy and Equity Committee Chair for the statewide Minnesota Association for Environmental Education. And I'm here to advocate to support the funding for HF 76, No Child Left Inside, at $2 million. As someone passionate about environmental education in Minnesota, I want to share findings from a 2019 University of Minnesota Duluth study about the positive impacts of environment-based education on cognitive health and mental well-being for secondary students. These are impacts which can arguably shape a lifetime of learning for students involved. As author Ava Robinson notes, environment-based education with its use of skills, interdisciplinary skills, and focus on experiential learning, it offers a pathway to meet psychological needs and sustain academic self-regulation and intrinsic motivation. She also cites one educator, Linda Hoodie, that capitalizing on a child's intrinsic interest in the natural world and actively engaging that child in the educational process would create an enthusiastic learner for a lifetime. Later in her study,
Mr. Young, can you send us that cited document? And that would be great. So that yes. The committee and the public can read it. And I'm assuming you're strongly in support of the program. Is that correct?
Very much so, yes. And I'd be happy to send that off to at least Representative Becker-Finn. Would that be okay? Or to yourself, Chairman?
I think Representative Becker-Finn is nodding her head, and she will get it to the end. The thumbs up. So I hate to cut you off and any of the members here to cut off, but I've got to get moving. So Sarah Milligan-Toffler, Children and Nature Network. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm pleased to provide some testimony today. I am the president and CEO of the Children and Nature Network, which is a national organization based in Minnesota that's working to address the fact that over the past 40 years, we've seen childhood move indoors. And so I am just going to give a couple of very brief points here to sort of amplify what some others have said. I'm sure many on the committee are aware that Minnesota's outdoor recreation industry makes up 2.4% of the state's GDP, which is significant. But what we're seeing is declining participation in the outdoors by children and youth. In fact, there was a 1.4% drop across the U.S. between 2017 and 2019. And early reports that we're seeing show that COVID has exacerbated this problem, with children spending even more time indoors and in front of screens. And then, as others have mentioned, low-income children, Black, Indigenous, Latinx, Asian children have lower rates of outdoor participation than their white peers. So given the vital role that outdoor recreation and just that, you know, that connection to the outdoors plays in our state's economic health, I think we would be really wise to invest in ensuring that the next generation has access to the many benefits of outdoor experiences everywhere they live, learn, and play. And this addition to the Leave No Child Inside, you know, would help to do that. I would also just like to add that allowing for outside of government contributions, I think is a really smart idea because, for example, the Children and Nature Network receives quite a bit of national funding that we often pass through to local communities to do these kinds of programs. So a program like this would allow an organization like ours, for example, to leverage state dollars in support of these efforts. And I will leave my testimony there. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And is Ms. Sherritt back? Ms. Sherritt? I think we're having difficulty there, and I do want to also ask Ms. Garrisu if she could provide her entire slideshow and any citations. That would be very helpful. We had to cut off there a little early, and I want to make sure we get that documentation. And all testifiers. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's clear the overwhelming support for this initiative and to continue to fund it to benefit all of our kids here in Minnesota. So I thank folks for their support. And I can get, if testifiers get me that information, I will pass it on to Mr. Meyer to send to the rest of the committee.
Seeing no discussion, Representative Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 76 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. House File 45, Representative Eklund, all terrain vehicle funding provided. And this is also going to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 45 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. House File 45 is an appropriation from the All Terrain Vehicle dedicated account to both the Voyager Country ATV Trail System and for design, right-of-way acquisition, permitting, and construction of Phase 1 Voyager Country Trail connection in the areas of Cook or Ash River, Cabotogama, and for Cabotogama Township and the City of International Falls. The Prospector Loop System will use $955,000 for new trail connections near Ely and a new bridge across the Beaver River, which will connect the Prospector Trail to the Taconite Trail. This bill also extends two past appropriations, one for the Voyager System and one for the Quad Cities ATV Club. The project that these appropriations are being used for have permitting delays and require this extension. These projects are supported by the statewide ATV Minnesota organization. Testifying today in support of the bill is Mark Anderson from the Voyager Country ATV Club, Nick Wagnum from the Prospector Loop Club, and Ron Potter, president of ATV Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. So I've got first Nick Wagnum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund. My name is Nick Wagnum. I'm the president of the Prospector Loop Alliance. We are a nonprofit group made up of representatives from Ely, Babbitt, Embarrass, Tower, and Lake County. We've been working on this project for 7 years now, and the goal is to connect those four communities and the Lake County with a 250-mile trail system. I'd like to thank the representatives who have signed on to this bill for their support of it. Last year, we hosted the state convention up here in the Ely area. We had over 300 riders come up and get a first look at the trail system, including a number of elected officials from Ely to St. Paul. We managed to conduct the event within COVID-19 guidelines. We're hosting it again this year, and here's your invitation. Please circle September 17 and 19 on your calendar and come on up and join us. We'd love to have you. We will be completing construction on much of the Prospector Loop this spring, thanks to supportive senators and representatives who have approved both bonding and ATV dedicated fund dollars previously. Today, we are back with a request for funding from the dedicated account for $455,000 in fiscal year 22 and $500,000 in fiscal year 23. These monies would be used for two initiatives. One is the Connect 4, which is four connections from the Prospector Trail, and the other is a bridge over the Beaver River. You should have handouts showing these connections. These projects have been reviewed by DNR's Tower Office and recommended by the ATV Minnesota State Organization. And we've seen a major increase in the number of ATVs sold in the past year in Minnesota as people during a pandemic use our trails for a safe, outdoor, environmentally friendly activity for families. I mentioned our board has been working on this for over 7 years. We've also had a growing membership of volunteers, now well over 200, who we can count on to help with maintenance in the years to come. As a member of the ADVAM Executive Board, we've been working to expand trail opportunities all across the state of Minnesota. We're putting together a request to conduct a statewide master plan of ATV trails in the state, Your support of our request will help further those opportunities right here in Northeast Minnesota. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wagnum. Mr. Anderson or Mr. Potter, do you have anything in addition to add to Mr. Wagnum had provided? Quickly.
Mr. Chairman, this is Ron Potter. I'm president of the ATV. I want to thank you for hearing this today and for Representative Eklund for carrying this bill. As Nick mentioned, we did see a tremendous increase in use last year, and I think that will continue. This funding helps us plan ahead for growth and to provide sustainable trails into the future for this type of use. We also would like to thank the Department of Natural Resources. Last year was difficult to put on training, and we know it's important to be able to train these new riders, but with the aid of the DNR, we were able to train 1,650 youth and 3,221 adults, so we can make sure that people are recreating safely and appropriately out there. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, anything new? We do have a citizen, Dan Wilm. Mr. Wilm? Mr. Wilm? Mr. Strohmeyer, are we having challenges with either of them?
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Proceed. State your name and who you're with for the record.
My name is Dan Wilm. I'm here as a private concerned citizen. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm a 34-year retired DNR forester. Back in 2003, I was working at the Backus DNR Forestry Office, and you may not remember this, but at that time, the Spider Lake Trail System, OHV ATV Trail System, was ground zero for everything that was wrong. And certainly, it was true. It was totally out of control. Riders were doing whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. And it took a determined effort of trails and waterways people, forestry people, and a conservation officer to stabilize this. And certainly Mr. Potter at the time was working either as the Trails and Waterways Manager at Tower or perhaps at Gilbert, but there was a campground on the north side of Spider Lake that the township owned, and the ATV OHVers drove through the campgrounds down into the lake, and we helped them close the campgrounds. Yet Mr. Potter wondered if we were ever going to reopen the campgrounds again. And my answer was absolutely not. We didn't mitigate all this and try to get it back to the condition it should be, just to watch it get torn apart again.
So Mr. Wilson, to the bill. House File 45.
Yes. Well, quickly. Quote from the Duluth News Tribune, July 5th, 2020. Maintenance is a big issue, especially with the big new machines. They have so much power, they can really tear up the trail if people aren't careful, Solar said. Dave Solar of Babbitt has been maintaining 60 miles of the Stony Spur Trail for more than a decade. I think it's foolish for us to just continue onward with these trails. We don't have a good inventory of the trails in Minnesota at all. It includes state, county lands, parks, county and township roads, private company lands like Mulpas, Blandon, UPM, invasives. I know this session we're talking about invasives and emissions. Both of those are issues propagated by ATV, OHV, OHM use. And I would like to say that we should not just proceed ahead without taking the time to pause and look at what we've got before we continue down this road.
Thank you, Mr. Wilm. We are laying this bill over. I've expressed to Representative Eklund that we need to look at the issue of emissions and climate change with off-road, off-highway vehicles. And so we appreciate your testimony and the testimony of all the presenters, and that concern I think we will be discussing more in the future as we prepare the omnibus bill. Representative Eklund renews his motion that House File 45 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. House File 191, Representative Kosnick, the Bilsby Dam Infrastructure and Construction Funding Provided. I will move that House File 191 be recommended to be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee without recommendation. Representative Kosnick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 191 seeks to shore up the funding gap for a 109-year-old hydro dam in Dakota County. It currently manages flooding on the Cannon River and produces enough energy to run Cannon Falls each year. And the turbines, after the turbines are replaced, the project will produce even more electricity to shore up this critical resource for years to come. And Dakota County operates the dam. And with me to testify are Commissioners Mike Slavik and a Dakota County employee. I don't know if he's the Environmental Resource Director. Josh Peterson, sorry about your title, didn't have that on here, to explain the project. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner and Mr. Peterson, you have 1 minute each, so we can, because we've already got a couple questions showing up. So, Commissioner Slavik.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I will actually just add one more thing onto what Representative Kosnick had said, and that is that in addition to this turbine project, the county has also put in about $12 million over the last number of years for dam safety, and I'll just defer the rest of my time to Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time today. Really quick, I'm going to pull up a presentation I have that's going to take just a minute. As stated, this is the Bilsby Dam Hydroelectric Redevelopment Project we're talking about. The turbine upgrade project is replacing a 110-year-old powerhouse structure and equipment with a brand new powerhouse structure and equipment. It's doubling capacity, adding another 2 megawatts of power to a total of 4 megawatts to the from a renewable energy standpoint. There's a couple renderings here showing what the final project's going to look like. The status of the project is we're basically at the ground floor of this. The equipment's on site, ready to be installed. We have a contractor on board ready to start mobilizing and working on preparing the dam to move forward with demolition of the existing structure and start the project itself. This has been an evolving project since we've been working on this since 2014 to 2021 now. It's went from a $14 million project to a $30 million project. We've currently received $12 million in state bonding, and we have right now $18 million committed in state and county dollars. The responsibility for the cost increase and that really fall down to three different categories. We've seen a huge cost increase due to construction costs in the last 6 to 7 years. Since 14 to 20, we've seen an increase of almost 20%. There's a lot of regulatory changes. This project wasn't meant to be a complete powerhouse replacement. But unfortunately, due to regulatory impacts, we had to essentially revise the thinking of how we can install equipment like this. So the regulatory being FERC, we were regulated by the federal government. There was also different issues with the State Historic Preservation and Fish and Wildlife that we had to clear for hurdles. And like I said, this is a complex project. We're trying to dissect a building off the side of a 110-year-old building with 110-year-old equipment off the 110-year-old dam. So it's an ever-evolving, complex project. With that, I'll yield for any questions.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is to the author or to the staff over at Dakota County. So I know that in the October bonding bill, we appropriated, the legislature appropriated $6 million to the projects. And initially, there was a bill that was carried by Representative Garofalo and Representative Hansen that asked for $9 million. And so can you tell us why you're back now for $9 million in the proposal from the RDA fund? And what's going to happen with the $6 million that was appropriated in October?
Representative Kosnick or staff?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I defer that to Mr. Peterson. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson.
Yes, I think the extra funding here is to shore up the difference in being a match from the state, 50-50. I don't think we're looking for anything that's more than a 50-50 match. Unfortunately, we're not sure if this is going to be a $30 million project or a $36 million project because we haven't gotten through the groundbreaking components of this structure. So until we really have a firm understanding of what we're digging into here, we're probably not going to know the final cost of the project. Unfortunately, it's just difficult to nail down on a project like this. So that's why the dollar amount's $9 million is kind of a placeholder to cover the difference. But the intent is to be a split.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I know that in the appropriation that we pass in October that there is going to be a report to myself and the Capital Investment Committee, Chair Hansen, and to Chair Long, the Energy Committee. Can you tell us from the appropriation from then until now if there's going to be any hindrance with regards to the information that will be provided to us as we evaluate this potential proposal going forward into the Energy Climate Committee too?
Mr. Peterson or Chair Slawik, Commissioner Slawik?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't expect there'd be a hindrance to that.
Representative Lee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really know what to expect now, and so I just want to let members of the committee know that we did fund this at $6 million in the bonding bill, and now this proposal is coming in for $9 million, and for all of us to consider this as we go forward and you know really look into this increased cost and whatnot. And so I hope that our colleagues over at the county will reach out and provide some needed information on the expenses and why the project has increased. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And members, this is here because of the DNR, so I need to get on the record. Who owns the dam now? Who will own the new dam? And who owns the power generated by the dam?
Mr. Chair, I would defer that to Mr. Peterson. I believe the answer is Dakota County, but I could be incorrect.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, it is correct. Dakota County owns the dam currently, and we do generate and sell the power right now to Xcel, but soon to be a different power purchase agreement.
And who would that power purchase agreement be with, could you say?
We're still negotiating. It's either going to be Xcel or it's going to be sold on the open market through the MISO process.
And would the DNR have to approve, issue the permit to tear down and rebuild the dam, or who is responsible for that? ECA, DNR?
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is ultimately responsible under the licensing process, but the DNR is involved from a water management standpoint as well. So we do have a lot of state impacts.
And is there anybody from the DNR here? I would ask that the DNR, you know, provide us with their perspective on this.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. There may be additional public water works permits that would be needed for any construction of the project, but we would certainly work with them on that as well. We understand the need to update this project. I'd also just like to bring to people's attention and Representative Fooley that last year's bonding bill requires the DNR to submit a report on behalf of the project. And if at all possible, that responsibility should be deferred to the county as it is a county project, not a DNR project. Chairman Fooley, I will speak with you about that offline.
Is there any discussion to the bill? Members, I would renew my motion that House File 191 be recommended to be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee without recommendation. The clerk would take the roll.
Hansen, Rick.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Wasilewick, Amy.
Wasilewick, aye.
Wasilewick, aye. Heinzman, Josh.
Aye.
Heinzman, aye. Akam, Patty.
Aye.
Akam, aye. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Backer, Jeff. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Backer, Finn, Jamie.
Aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Eklund, Rob.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve.
Aye.
Green, aye. Igo, Spencer.
Igo, aye.
Igo, aye. Jordan, Sydney.
Aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Tice, Tama.
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye. That is 19 ayes and 0 noes.
Motion is adopted without recommendation. Members, we're at 2:30. We are adjourned.